I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Two Louisville police officers involved in the raid where Breonna Taylor was shot and killed are being fired. That's according to lawyers for detectives Joshua Janes and Miles Cosgrove. The two received their pre-termination letters yesterday. Back in March, police raided Taylor's apartment. Her death sparked widespread protests. And over the summer, there was a major push to terminate the officers involved. At that time, only one officer had been fired until now. And for the latest, let's bring in Ryan Van Velzer. He's a reporter for Louisville Public Media. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan, Breonna Taylor's name is one that many know by now, but remind us why officers executed that search warrant and the roles these two officers played in her death.
Right. So the search warrant was based on LMPD's narcotics investigation into Taylor's ex-boyfriend, Jamarcus Glover. Police executed several simultaneous warrants that night, and one was Taylor's. When they entered her apartment, Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, fired a single shot at police. He said later that he thought they were being robbed. Police returned fire, killing Taylor. But as it turns out, the warrant for Taylor's apartment was based on faulty information provided by one of the detectives who is now facing termination.
Yeah, and these two officers, can you give me more detail on their involvement here?
Right. Okay, so Detective Joshua Janes wasn't actually present during the raid, but he obtained the search warrant for Taylor's apartment. In securing the warrant, Janes said he had verified with the postal inspector that Taylor was receiving packages on behalf of her ex-boyfriend. Only Janes never actually did verify it with the inspector. Janes has admitted some language is incorrect in an affidavit for that search warrant. But Louisville's interim police chief called it a lie in this pre-termination letter and cited it as a reason why she believes Janes should be fired. Less is known about the reasons why LMPD has decided to move forward with terminating Detective Miles Cosgrove, the other officer. What we do know is that he was present during the raid and that he fired the fatal round that killed Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Before yesterday, the only officer to be fired in connection with this case was Officer Brett Hankinson. Back in June, he was not charged with anything directly related to Taylor's death, though. And why was that?
So Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron established a grand jury to look into the case, but he never actually presented them with charges related to Taylor's death. Cameron has said the grand jury agreed with prosecutors that officers were justified in their use of deadly force against Kenneth Walker. That's Breonna Taylor's boyfriend. That during the raid. But three anonymous grand jurors have since spoken out and said that they didn't agree and were only presented charges against one officer, Brett Hankinson. The grand jury indicted him on three counts of wanton endangerment for bullets fired into a neighboring apartment, but he wasn't charged related to Taylor's death.
Okay. Why is the Louisville Metro Police Department deciding to take action against Cosgrove and Janes now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Hankinson was fired for his, quote, extreme indifference to human life when he fired blindly into Taylor's apartment. Those findings were part of a criminal investigation conducted by LMPD into Taylor's death, and the final decision was made by LMPD's former police chief. These latest actions against Cosgrove and Janes are based on a separate internal investigation by the Professional Standards Unit within LMPD. The decision to go ahead with the terminations was made by LMPD's new interim police chief, Yvette Gentry, who is the first Black woman to lead the department, by the way.
Taylor's family has called for criminal charges against all of the officers involved. How likely is that to happen, especially based on what has happened over the last few months?
You know, at this point, that depends on how the federal investigation turns out. Although Tamika Palmer, that's Breonna Taylor's mother, has requested a new special prosecutor at the state level, the board that oversees that is unlikely to grant her request. So if there's going to be any charges, most likely going to come from the federal investigation, which is ongoing.
What are you hearing from the community? How are they responding?
You know, it's difficult for me to summarize just how big of an impact the protest movement has had on the city and the state. People have been in the streets for more than 200 days, and the entire time they've been calling for the officers involved to be fired. More than 800 people have been arrested. The city's working on a number of reforms, and lawmakers like Representative Attica Scott are pushing legislation for statewide reforms. Protest organizer Shamika Parrish Wright says that this is a positive step forward, but a lot of harm would have been prevented if LMPD had come to these decisions sooner.
When you delay that kind of justice, when you delay that accountability, it sends the wrong message to our young people. It sends the wrong message to any other community that's watching us right now. And so now LMPD has a lot of penance to pay. They have to do the right thing moving forward. We're not accepting anything else.
Ryan, there's a lot to follow here, including whether other officers will face termination. We'll be following it. Thank you so much for this report. Ryan Van Velzer is reporter from Louisville Public Media.
Well, to Argentina now, where celebrations broke out early this morning. Sound from outside the Congressional Palace in Buenos Aires after Argentina's Senate passed a groundbreaking new law in Pope Francis' homeland legalizing abortion up to the 14th week of pregnancy for any reason. Until now, abortions were only permitted in cases of rape or when the mother's health was at risk. It's estimated that thousands of women in Argentina have died or been hospitalized because of illegal abortions over the decades. After the vote, the lawmaker who drafted the law, Vilma Ibarra, broke down in tears and said, "Never again will there be a woman killed in a clandestine abortion in Argentina." BBC South America correspondent Katie Watson is here. Katie, this new law had already passed the lower house in Argentina. The vote in the Senate was 38 in favor, 29 against, and one abstention. How contentious was the debate?
Well, this did divide Argentina. It was not the first time that it reached this point. Just over 2 years ago, a similar bill narrowly got voted down by the Senate. And the difference with this was that the president, Alberto Fernandez, had backed this. It was part of his campaign promise when he ran for election as president last year. And it was a vote that had been delayed because of the pandemic. And the feeling was that it was, you know, the backing by the president certainly helped push this vote through. But it's got to be said that the other, you know, strong element of this was the powerful women's movement that's been really behind this movement, that's been really behind this bill for years. It's not the first time, and it's been something that they've really campaigned for. So it was seen as a very historic movement. But of course, as you mentioned, it's also a deeply Catholic country. There's a strong evangelical community as well, and they certainly put up a fight as well to put their views across that this was a law that shouldn't be passed. But in the end, it was a yes vote for those who wanted to change a law that's, you know, nearly 100 years old.
Yeah. And tell us more about what this means for women in Argentina, because we're wondering, does the medical infrastructure exist to even carry out legal abortions?
I think one of the biggest things, and one of the things that the campaigners for this law had pushed, was that this wasn't an issue of whether you were for or against abortion. It wasn't a religious issue, it wasn't a moral issue, it was a health issue. And in a country that's deeply unequal, wealthier women could access abortions abroad or pay for, you know, clandestine abortions that were done in a professional manner. But it was the poorer, more vulnerable communities that really suffered as a result. And it's something that the president himself said when he introduced the bill again. You know, there are as many as 40,000 women a year hospitalised because of botched abortions. And that's something that was very important, that it was important that women could access safe ways of terminating, because at the end of the day, they would be accessing them anyway. And that was the main argument, if you like, to try and push this bill through.
Yeah. Well, so now Argentina becomes Latin America's largest country to legalize abortion. What's the sense of other countries in the region following?
I think that a lot of other countries will be looking at, I mean, they've been following it very closely, and the implications could be, you know, far-reaching. I'm in Brazil, and in Chile, certainly activists will have been encouraged by seeing this vote to see whether they can rewrite the law in their own countries. Uruguay, Guyana, in South America, those are the only countries that have legalized abortion. In North America, there's Mexico City. But in Central America, it's still very, very restrictive when it comes to abortion, outlawed totally. So I think that we could see a change in attitude, certainly as a result of what we've seen in Argentina today.
The BBC's South America correspondent, Katie Watson. Katie, thank you.
Thanks.
Let's get to that stunning new information about the Christmas Day RV bombing in downtown Nashville. According to the Tennessean newspaper, police officers visited the home of Anthony Quinn Warner, the suspected suicide bomber, in August of 2019, almost a year and a half ago, after Warner's girlfriend and her lawyer told police he was making bombs in his RV. But in the hours after the explosion last week, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation said Warner had not been on the radar. Natalie Allison broke this story for the Tennessean. Natalie, thanks for being here. And you got this new information through documents. From where?
Yeah, Robin, thanks for having me. We got this from a police report from the Metro Nashville Police Department. I put in a request with the department yesterday evening for this information, and then the department sent that over, and also some statements clarifying what they did subsequently, although they didn't provide a report of what they did after they received this information about the bombs and did a preliminary investigation.
Well, walk us through. Tell us more about what this girlfriend and her lawyer, who was present with her when she spoke to police officers, what did she say?
Yeah, so this woman, at the time in August 2019, she was having what officers and what her attorney later told me appeared to be a mental health crisis. But during the course of that, she reported to police and to an attorney she had at the time, who she called because she just didn't know who else to call, that Anthony Warner, who was a close friend of hers, was making bombs in the RV at his house. She also said a number of other things to the attorney, which is what he told me, that she was concerned that Warner was spying on her, maybe was poisoning her. And so the attorney wasn't really sure what to make of it, but ultimately did urge law enforcement to check out her claims that Anthony Warner was making bombs at his RV.
So that's interesting. There might have been a sense that this was part of some sort of a mental breakdown she was having. But then tell us more about what happened when the police actually went to his house. They saw the RV.
Yeah, so the police, the attorney, you know, I think everyone was aware of the fact that this woman was in some type of mental distress. But after, you know, she was taken to get some help psychologically, the police did go over to Tony Warner's house. And they knocked on the door several times. He didn't come to the door. They noticed there was an RV in the backyard, but it was behind a fence, and they didn't have the right to go, you know, in his backyard behind the fence to check it out. So they wrote up a report. They notified supervisors. They notified the department's bomb squad of this. The next day, the department alerted the FBI about this. The FBI quickly got back with them and said, no, we don't have anything on this man. And it appears that from then on, nothing else was really done, at least not that we know about. The department essentially moved on.
Well, and then we come to the Christmas bombing, after which, you know, officials there in Nashville said Warner hadn't been known to them prior to Christmas morning. How are they now reconciling that with what you're reporting?
We're still waiting for an explanation on why they never brought this up to us in the numerous press conferences that police have held since Christmas morning. They failed to mention this August 2019 call that they responded to. We're still awaiting answers to those questions, and I think that the police department is going to have to explain their reasoning for not being upfront with them.
Well, as you know, Natalie, there are so many other questions. Was there anything in those documents that would answer why Warner was building a bomb in his RV, as the girlfriend said?
Not in this police report. The police report from that day is very basic. And as I mentioned, the police department provided some supplemental information to clarify some of what was in the report. But I spoke with the attorney who was involved in this incident, and he said that he knew Tony Warner somewhat. He described him as someone who seemed very unhappy with life, very distrustful. But there's really no clear motive as of yet. There's certainly rumors circulating and ideas about was he into this conspiracy or that conspiracy. I can tell you that the FBI has confirmed to us that they are closely investigating whether Tony Warner was a subscriber to a couple of different conspiracy theories. And those are some things that law enforcement are looking into, but we still know very little about how important these potential conspiracy theories were to Tony Warner.
Natalie Allison of the Tennessee newspaper there in Nashville. Natalie, thank you so much for your reporting.
Yeah, thanks, Robin.
Well, they say it's partly because of all the terrible news this past year that antacids are selling out. Tums, Pepcid's generic version, Famotidine, are the new toilet paper. In fact, Wegmans was limiting shoppers to just two packets to prevent hoarding. Wow, thank goodness I have a prescription. Yes, I and some of my Here and Now colleagues may have fallen victim to pandemic stomach, as it's being called. But this isn't always the heartburn associated with spicy or acidic foods. Only 20% of people with what's called reflux get heartburn or GERD. The rest, including me, may have no idea they have laryngopharyngeal reflux, or LPR, maybe a running nose or sore throat. If reflux goes on for a long time, our next guest says you should get screened. It could be something worse. Dr. Tom Carroll is an otolaryngologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston who specializes in the throat and whose camera or scope went down mine. Dr. Carroll, welcome.
Well, thanks, Robin. Great to be here.
This isn't about a shortage of famotidine because President Trump was treated with it with a claim that it reduced symptoms of his COVID-19. The New York Times reports there's been no conclusive studies about its effectiveness, but still people are hoarding it. This isn't about that. You know, people are buying up antacids for acid indigestion or for heartburn. Why do you think this is happening?
I definitely am a believer that stress plays a role in reflux. And it may not be that it actually increases the amount of reflux that people get, but rather makes us more sensitive to the reflux we already have.
This is gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. Stomach acids back up as far as like the esophagus in the case of GERD. Our apologies if you're having breakfast or lunch, depending on where you are in the country. But as I learned from you, we now move on to, well, you say it.
Yeah, laryngopharyngeal reflux. Let's just call it LPR. It's easier.
Okay.
So LPR is basically when that stomach juice makes its way up the esophagus and actually spills over into the throat. But the most common symptoms are not heartburn and regurgitation. The most common symptoms are things like a cough or throat clearing or post-nasal drip. Post-nasal drip is probably a reflux symptom.
And you don't call it acid reflux because it could be a stomach enzyme like pepsin floating up.
When pepsin gets deposited in the throat, it can stay there for hours. And then other things that we eat and drink, such as coffee or dark chocolate, wine, it's not the caffeine in the coffee. You can drink decaf. It's the acidity. Those foods will reactivate pepsin, which then causes inflammation in the tissue.
Well, this was what was such a shock to me and some of my colleagues who had sore throats, or I had a choking cough. It was frightening. I mean, I had COVID tests because It was just so choking. We never had heartburn.
I find the most difficult cough patients to be those that have been treated for everything under the sun except for the non-acidic reflux.
Yeah. While the GERD goes to your esophagus, this LPR, it goes up beyond into the voice box, maybe even into your sinuses. But it sounds as if for both, there's some recommendations. Now, again, we highly recommend people go see a doctor. But if you cut out certain foods, sit up at night when you sleep, I mean, what are some of the other things that people can do to get relief?
Yeah, it's interesting. When we actually test people, we find that people with LPR more commonly have daytime upright symptoms. And people with GERD and heartburn often do wake up with a cough in the middle of the night because they're flat. It probably is a good idea for people with any reflux type issue to sleep with an incline and not necessarily just on pillows because you slide off of them. Not eating close to bedtime, losing a little weight if you're overweight because that puts more abdominal pressure on you. And then there are medications that we use. And interestingly, you know, 5 years ago, we were pretty much prescribing medications called proton pump inhibitors for almost every patient we suspected of having reflux.
These are acid reducers like Prilosec.
Mm-hmm. And in the last couple years, we've actually switched gears and realized that we're not treating the reflux. We were treating just the acidity. And while that does work for probably two-thirds of people, there's another whole third of people out there that aren't going to respond to acid blockers. So we're using a lot more of products made with alginates in them, which is basically made from brown seaweed. It basically forms a raft on top of whatever's in their stomach so that the stomach contents, the liquid, can't go up into their esophagus and subsequently can't go up into their throat.
This is the Gaviscon?
Yes. Gaviscon products, or there's a new product called Reflux Gourmet that's made in California. The problem is we can't just go to the U.S. pharmacies and buy Gaviscon because it's a different product, believe it or not. There's a Canadian version that's great, but people can, you know, order them on Amazon. I feel like I'm going to flood the market here. If I tell people about this, we'll never be able to get them again. But they really are terrific. And for people even with heartburn or regurgitation, they form a barrier.
So we've had this past year. Did you see more people come in?
We did. We saw spikes, and those people were the people who are, you know, losing jobs, having to stay home all day, being stressed out by the pandemic. Definitely. Robin, we've seen so many more cases of what we would suspect being LPR than we did before the pandemic.
That's Dr. Tom Carroll, otolaryngologist and director of the VOICE program at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Carroll, thank you so much for sharing some of your expertise.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Robin.
And again, see your doctor if your symptoms are chronic. You know, small chance it could be something much worse. But that better Gaviscon he mentioned that forms a barrier, it has directions in French to distinguish it if you order it. And there are people who need famotidine to treat other illnesses. So people, let's not hoard it. More on reflux at hereandnow.org. And as this year comes to an end, thank you, many people are scrambling to use or lose their vacation days, which is forcing employers to adapt. Some companies, like Bank of America, are changing policies and allowing vacation days to roll over into next year. Others are encouraging employees to take time off by offering more vacation days next year. So how has the pandemic changed how we take paid vacation, if we're lucky enough to have it? Robin Farzad has been looking into this. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Good day. You should know I just popped a Tums, incidentally.
Don't hoard.
I have existential reflux, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, we've got everything, including this year with the pandemic. Fewer people took vacation to travel, another reason why we're popping Tums. I mentioned Bank of America, but what are other companies doing to address that?
Pretty much every HR manager has been on this steep learning curve, not just in 2020, but really going into the reopening. The rollover of unused days, at least into the first quarter, has been a common response. The problem is, Robin, are you going to have a flood of employees simultaneously putting in for badly needed vacation all at the same time? Can you afford to let a burnt out team take a vacation in a block? Other companies are tacking on days to future vacation years. And yet others, you know, on the flip side, they've asked their workers to forgive these days in the interest of avoiding layoffs or even further furloughs.
Well, let's just touch on that, because many people may feel pressure to not take vacation. And you're saying some are even, you know, being asked.
Yeah, I mean, when it's put in stark terms, like, you know, we can amortize your misery over a year, or we could have layoffs, and you're going to see some of your colleagues leave, and you're going to have this anvil hanging over your head. It further kind of entrenches this idea of the vacation not really being your property. It's something that's fungible and your employer can take back.
Yeah, well, we know that California and Montana have laws around vacation time. So what protections are offered there?
Yeah, there are a handful of states that formalize the view that vacation days are the property of the employee. So it makes it far more difficult for employers to assert, for example, use it or lose it, or strict rollover. Of course, that can make companies more skittish of hiring people full on with full benefits if they know that it's not just easy to move vacation around or take it back.
Yeah. The U.S. Travel Association reported that in 2018, so this is before the pandemic, Americans left 768 million vacation days unused. This, you know, why is that?
You know, we all joke about the French and their vacation time, or Spaniards and siesta. But in the same breath, Robin, I mean, you know that person bragging about how much vacation she hasn't taken over so many years, like how many millions of frequent flyer miles accumulated from traveling the globe for work. What's the point if you don't take it? Is relaxation or balance optional? There's something culturally about the United States workforce and work ethic that you kind of wear as this badge of honor that you don't take vacation. I think a lot of people are going to rethink that, to the extent that they were homebound this year and yet they worked more and they're burnt out more than they have been in memory.
Yeah. Look, that person may be thinking, but this is so important to bring people the news. Oh, wait, that's me. That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, I want to take a second to say Happy New Year to you. We so appreciate you and have appreciated
you. And I so appreciate you guys. Thank you for everything, and looking forward to 2021.
The ball is now in the Senate's court to decide the size of the check many Americans will get in direct pandemic aid. The $600 approved by Congress last week could be bumped up to $2,000, as President Trump and Democrats want. But so far, that is facing resistance from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He blocked a vote on a standalone bill passed by the House earlier this week and instead introduced another bill that includes provisions to study election security and to scrap some legal protections for social media companies. That bill is unlikely to pass, and Congress is running out of time on the direct payments, with the new Congress scheduled to convene on Sunday. Those checks are part of that massive coronavirus bill that President Trump signed on Sunday, which also includes extended support for unemployed people. Joining us now to answer some frequently asked questions about unemployment benefits is Michelle Evermore. She's a senior policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. She's also a volunteer member of President-elect Biden's transition team for the Labor Department. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. So you've been helping unemployed people make sense of what's going on and to advocate for them through this pandemic. What shape would you say our country is in right now in supporting people who are out of work?
Well, I think that this has been a difficult system for people to navigate, but it's been a lifeline for millions and millions of people. There are a lot of improvements that we need to make in the unemployment insurance system, and this pandemic has laid bare all of those shortcomings.
You receive letters and phone calls from lots of unemployed people who are seeking help. What are some of the letters or calls that really struck you?
I'm getting letters from people who are living in a car somewhere, living off $125 a week with, you know, children. They send me pictures of their children. I've gotten letters about people who are contemplating suicide in order to be able to provide so that their kids can get their pension and insurance money. People are really desperate. They're really at their wit's end.
Many of those who are out of work are also concerned about what's in this latest coronavirus relief package. What is in this new package that is specifically geared to help people who are out of work?
So there's 11 more weeks of benefits for people collecting who were either eligible for regular unemployment insurance and then got moved into pandemic emergency unemployment compensation. There's also 11 more weeks available for people who are in pandemic unemployment assistance, or the parallel program to unemployment insurance for people who don't qualify for regular UI. There's also an additional $300 a week for the next 11 weeks added to anybody's benefit, no matter what kind of unemployment insurance benefit you're getting. And on top of that, there's another $100 a week for people who are making a very small amount of unemployment insurance, but would have gotten a bigger pandemic unemployment assistance amount if they hadn't qualified for regular unemployment insurance.
President Trump signed the relief bill on Sunday instead of Saturday, which was the deadline before these benefits would expire. This could cost millions of unemployed folks at least a week of benefits, but you say there might actually be a loophole here.
Yes, very good news. We've been hearing reports coming out of the Labor Department that they have actually figured out how to make sure that this week is covered. So people will continue to accrue benefits this week. There will be a lag in terms of when people see these benefits. It takes a while for states to program the new programs into their computer systems. But this week, people will be eligible for a benefit.
What else do people who are out of work need to consider so that they can keep getting unemployment benefits in the weeks ahead?
I think, you know, just being very careful to follow all of the rules that your unemployment agency sets forth. Make sure you continue to certify every week or every other week, if that's the case in your state, that you're able, available, and actively seeking work. Even if work search requirements are waived, you still have to report that you'd like a job if somebody offered you one.
States are still working out kinks in their unemployment systems. One of the issues involves overpayment. Some states are claiming they mistakenly overpaid some unemployed people and are now asking them to return that money. We actually had a listener tell us about his experience with this. Let's take a listen.
My name is Mark Muldoon. I live in Vancouver, Washington, and my occupation is a rideshare driver for Lyft and Uber. Back in July, when they were finally getting my back unemployment sent to me, I got a letter from the state of Washington saying that I owed them $10,000 or $13,000. I like freaked out. You know, I read the letter and it says you have 30 days to appeal. And I put together a packet, maybe a half an inch thick, and overnighted it up to the Capitol to prove that I didn't owe a dime. And then about 6 days later, I got a phone call from my worker at the state. And she said, big screw up. Just ignore what happened there. They put some information incorrectly. It's happened to a few people. We're getting it corrected. But she said, just don't pay any attention to it.
Man, my heart is beating just listening to Mark's experience. He has since then been able to clear things up, but he knows the other rideshare drivers that he works with, some of them are actually going through this. How much of a problem has overpayment been?
I think that this is going to turn out to be a massive problem. You know, pandemic unemployment assistance is a brand new program, often set up by brand new entities, staffed by new people, and applying to people who've never gotten unemployment insurance before. And so there's going to be mistakes. There were three different changes in the initial guidance about what the rules are around pandemic unemployment assistance. States got letters over the summer that they were not implementing PUA correctly, and they had to do a lot of, they had to ask clients for a lot more information. Otherwise, those clients would be deemed overpaid. And that information is maybe not something that people could provide. So I am expecting millions of people to get a notice that they've been flagged for overpayment. The really good news is this new relief package includes a waiver so that states can forgive overpayments if it was an honest mistake for reasons of equity and good conscience.
Okay, so there is a way to circumvent this or to get out of this. I mean, can you say more about this?
Well, there's two ways to get out of it. Number one is basically just appealing, as Mark did in Washington. And, you know, if it was an honest mistake, an appeal may not just erase what you've been overpaid, but allow you to continue to receive benefits. So appealing is important. It's an important right for people to have. The second thing is, if the appeal doesn't go the right way, states do now have the authority to waive that overpayment that they didn't have prior to enactment of this act.
Okay. You know, the resounding message we heard from so many listeners is how difficult it's been, though, to get answers from states about their unemployment claims, especially early on. What's the situation like now? I mean, if someone like Mark needs to be in direct contact with a person, have these states improved their systems?
Yes, a couple of things have happened. States have set up call-in centers. They've figured out ways to set up automatic callbacks. More states are adding live chats to their website for people uncomfortable talking on the phone. And in general, you know, the volume has subsided enough that they're not getting as much incoming as they used to be. So from what I'm hearing, it's a little bit easier to get a callback from an agency.
Looking ahead into the next year, what do you think should be the top priorities to help people who are out of work?
So one thing that happened this year is that the new programs papered over big problems in the unemployment insurance system. So the current unemployment insurance system pays far too few people far too low benefits. And, you know, honestly, if I ran the world, I would federalize the unemployment insurance system, have an equal system across states. I mean, if you look at Mississippi or Louisiana with average benefits around $213 a week, that's just not sufficient. It only replaces, you know, a third of income in some places, whereas others, it replaces half of income. I would set up a fair state system that looks a lot more like Massachusetts' system than Mississippi's.
Michelle Evermore is a senior policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. She's also a volunteer member of President-elect Biden's transition review team for the Labor Department. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Courtney Farr grew up in western Kansas in Scott City, population 3,800. That's where his father, Marvin Farr, died of COVID on December 1st. But the obituary that Courtney Farr wrote for the funeral home website drew notice across the country. He spoke to Celia Yopis Jepson of the Kansas News Service about it.
The opening of the obituary that Courtney Farr wrote channels his grief for his dad, Marvin, and the grief that so many families feel. It says, Marvin was preceded in death by more than 260,000 Americans infected with COVID-19. He died in a room not his own, being cared for by people dressed in confusing and frightening ways. He was not surrounded by friends and family. Courtney Farr wrote it for his hometown, but people have shared those words over and over. They've shown up in stories by The Washington Post, CNN, and USA Today. Courtney talked to me about why he wrote them.
There's no way to be prepared for how heartbreaking and difficult saying goodbye through a video call is.
We sat 6 feet apart on his porch off a gravel road in East Kansas, a 5-hour drive from where his dad died in a rural nursing home. Courtney saw him hours before he passed.
They, took the tablet they use in to the quarantine wing with him. And when my mother died 2 years ago, though, that was the first time I had ever sat with someone as they were dying. It was really good and meaningful to sit with her. And then doing this video call with Dad was so much harder and so much worse that you want to reach out and you want to touch him. You want to hold his hand. He had, you know, some amount of alertness, but he clearly was not really able to, like, kind of focus.
In Kansas, more than 400 COVID outbreaks have struck nursing homes and similar facilities since March, killing more than 700 people. Courtney got the call on Thanksgiving, letting him know his dad had tested positive.
He was asymptomatic for maybe about 36 hours, and then it progressed very rapidly. Started showing signs of fluid in his lungs, his oxygen levels were dropping, and he passed away on Tuesday afternoon.
Marvin was born in 1939. Courtney put it this way in the obituary. He was born into an America recovering from the Great Depression and about to face World War II. Americans would be asked to ration essential supplies and send their children around the world to fight. He died in a world where many of his fellow Americans refused to wear a piece of cloth on their face to protect one another. This is a key point for Courtney. He thinks about his dad's grandma.
She was a widow who raised 5 children during the Great Depression, during a drought, on a farm by herself in the 30s. Can you imagine trying to tell her, oh, I had to wear a piece of cloth over my mouth and I couldn't go eat at restaurants for 12 months?
As soon as the obituary ran, Courtney was swamped with comments and messages from people who feel like he does. There was some pushback, too.
One of the things I see brought up from people who won't take this seriously is that, oh, well, you know, it's only the really elderly mostly who are dying. It's only people who were probably going to die anyways. You know, why can't the rest of us just get on with our lives? And the thing of it is, my father falls into that category. He was probably going to die, you know, in the coming months.
Marvin was on hospice. He had advanced dementia.
It mattered how he died, not just that he died. And the tragedy there and the trauma there is not just his or mine or my family's. It's also the healthcare workers taking care of him. It's traumatic for them because they're having to deal with the quarantine ward and the isolation, and it's awful for everyone.
It bothers Courtney that masks and social distancing have been politicized. Marvin was a farmer and a veterinarian. Courtney wrote, "The science that guided his professional life has been disparaged and abandoned by so many of the same people who depended on his knowledge to care for their animals and to raise their food."
Both my mother and my father had the same hospice nurse, and her primary focus is to make sure that people can pass in comfort and with dignity. And right now, we as a society are failing that in so many ways for hundreds of thousands of people.
Marvin was 81 years old, gregarious, funny, charismatic.
Everybody loved my father.
Episcopalian, devout. He believed he'd see his loved ones again after death. The family won't hold a memorial until it's safe. Courtney has this favorite photo of himself and his dad from 1979 in their Scott City home. And it makes him think about all the years his dad cared for him.
I am napping on Dad's chest as a little kid. It is so peaceful and beautiful. A young father and his young son asleep together. And I couldn't be there for him at the end.
For Here and Now, I'm Celia Yopis Jepson.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.